Everyone called trying to get me out of it. They told me I had 2 weeks to choose a service or I was going to be inducted into the Army. So I started shopping military services. I went to the Army, and I knew I didn't want to do that. Army would be straight off to Vietnam, as would the Marine Corps. And besides the Marine Corps, those guys are crazy. Went to the Navy. I liked the bell-bottom jeans and the cambray shirts that they had. But, you know, the idea of being out on a ship a long time, 6 months at a time, I'm a Florida boy. But even at that, I'd like to go fishing and come home at night.
And not even a woman in every port would have.
No. And so the Air Force, when I went to him, you know, they had cool blue uniforms. And he said, look, son, even if you do go to Vietnam, what I'm going to do for you is I'm going to make you an air traffic controller. So you'll be hundreds of miles away from any enemy in an air-conditioned control tower. And look at the job you can have when you get out. An air traffic control is a very good position, great retirement. You know, I'm a teenage kid. I'm 19 years old, and I wasn't looking at retirement or anything. But, you know, it did sound good being an air-conditioned control tower, even if I did go to Vietnam, the tech sergeant said. So I joined and went to tech school, went to basic training in tech school, and came out of tech school and I was in the top 10% of the class. I'll be darned. And they said, well, because you're in the top 10% of the class, you know, you earned some kudos and some benefits. That's what we, and there were a few of us that, together. And they said, we're going to send you to jump school to learn how to parachute. Ah, cool. That sounds like fun. So we went to Benning. We went to Fort, to Army jump school, learned how to parachute. Then from there we went to jungle training and we went to all kinds of cool stuff. We even ended up going to Panama for dive training, scuba. Yeah, I'm a Florida boy. I was a scuba diver anyhow. So, but, you know, they taught us some other cool stuff. They sent us through explosives training, sea survival school, all these great schools. And then the next thing I know, they were shipping us off to Vietnam. And it's funny, in one of the schools, you know, we were just there. We thought nothing of it. The technical instructor told us, we better get serious because there's a lot of lives on the line, a lot of lives depending on us. And we said, well, yeah, but I don't need this jungle training to work in a control tower. I said, you know, and he said, son, what do you think you're going to be doing? I said, well, I'm an air traffic controller. He said, when you finish here, you're a combat controller. And a combat controller, you know what they do, son? I said, no, sir, tech sergeant. He said, if you imagine, he drew on a piece of paper, over here is the enemy, and another circle on the other side of the paper, over there is the friendly. And he said, and you're going to come in an aircraft, and you're going to jump in between the two and call in the airstrikes and the enemy. I said, alone? He said, oh, no. We're going to send someone with you to make sure that you don't get captured because you'll have all the codes. I said, well, how is he going to make sure I don't get captured? And he just looked at me. I knew the meaning of that. It meant that I was to be taken out by the other person. Well,
yeah, so you were really shoved shoved into the firestorm.
Yeah, 19-year-old kid. when I got to, I was assigned to, ended up ultimately going temporary duty to Thailand. When I got to Thailand, we were there in support of a company called Air America. It was a civilian company, but they were flying rice and supposedly humanitarian flights in throughout Cambodia. Excuse me, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, helping out the effort, helping out the villages and so forth. And they kept getting shot down. And so our job was to jump in this forward air control position I was assigned to, jump in, extract the pilot if he survived, extract any cryptographic gear out of the aircraft, and any of the cargo that we could get. And that was our duty and calling. They're out of NKP, Non-Com Phnom Thailand. But when I got there, I was recruited into a different mission. And I was recruited into that mission because the COMO man in a special operations team that was over there had broken his leg in a training exercise. And that mission ended up being a, I guess it would be called the first false flag mission that I'm aware of in the United States. I know there were probably many more before that, but we were tasked, Lon Nol, the premier of Cambodia, was a fence setter. He was taking monies from the United States and arms and military gear, and he was also doing the same thing with China. Uh-huh. And the president needed Cambodia to get on the wagon and support the Vietnam effort because the United States wanted to pull out. And if we pulled out, we needed boots on the ground. I know we've all heard that term lately. We needed boots on the ground in support of the South Vietnamese. So the idea was to get Cambodia's military trained and in place for that. But Lon Nol was sitting on the fence. He was happy pulling in money from each side, just like Turkey is now. Pulling in from this, pulling in for that, waiting to see what happened. And so we, it was decided in Washington that something would have to happen. You know, North Vietnamese had to do something to tick off Lon Nol and make him want to come over to the U.S. side completely and drop the CHICOM side.
So you were involved. You were involved with a false flag to basically, you know, make the war happen properly.
To pull him off the fence and support the United States, let us put troops in, train them, and have them go to war. Yes.
Right. Wow. Well, Ollie, do you want to jump in here and ask any questions from there? Because obviously your life changed quite considerably after that, Chip.
No, it's the Red Rock operation you're talking about, yeah?
Yeah, that's Operation Red Rock, Ollie. Uh-huh.
Yeah. No, please continue going into more details.
Well,
and also, Chip, if you wouldn't mind telling about, I mean, last time we spoke about this, you talked about it like it was almost like reading out of a book. But for most of us who are not used to being shot at or being in combat situations, it's like, how did you experience? I mean, you were only 19, and if you could go into a little bit of detail about that as well, if you don't mind.
Well, you know, I was a Florida boy and I was raised hunting, so I was very good with a weapon. But you, when you're in combat, it's different than shooting at a squirrel or shooting at a rabbit. Hell, they don't have guns. They don't shoot back. And it was very difficult because a lot of our enemy were very young. You know, these were some of the Viet Cong looked to be teenage kids. And beyond that, they weren't real large people anyhow. And they all looked so young to us, even though I was young. But they looked so much younger than me. And it was very difficult. But I'll tell you, Ole, once they start firing at you and the adrenaline starts flowing and you start shaking, things change. You either fire back or you die. And after your first couple kills, after the first couple times you see your buddy's brains blown out or his guts hanging out of his stomach, you get angry. You get very angry. And there are actual stages that our special ops captain explained to me when I was put on this special team to go into Phnom Penh Airport during Operation Red Rock and blow up the airport dressed as Viet Cong. That was the false flag. We dressed as Viet Cong. We went in. We blew up the airport along with the presidential aircraft. We gave them all to him anyhow. We left Viet Cong bodies on the ground so that Lon Nol and his military and his cabinet all thought that the North Vietnamese had broken their trust and attacked the airport. They immediately called the U.S. for support and help, and the U.S. already had aircraft and supplies waiting offshore. And within 2 days, he was restocked with Marine recon patrols on the ground and trainers on the ground training his troops. So it was a very successful mission. The only problem with that mission was, when it was all said and done, Nixon was so paranoid about someone finding out what we had done that he ordered that the aircraft weren't to pick us up. There was a group of Montagnards that helped us infiltrate Cambodia, and those same Montagnards were a transport out of Phnom Penh after the successful operation, and I would say very successful. Not one man was lost. But they attempted to assassinate us, the Montagnards did, after the operation. They were unsuccessful in that due to the training and expertise of our platoon leader and platoon sergeant. They caught on early to their little game and were waiting for them and instead took them out.
That's incredible that they were just going to leave their boys and not really care about your lives.
Well, as time went on and as I worked through the government, Sean, I came to realize that the government really holds no real value in an American soldier's life. They're just something means for the end. That's all we are. We're a particular means to utilize to gain some particular end. And the end game is all that matters to them. The losses in between really don't matter. As a matter of fact, it's less for them to be concerned about. Yeah, and you see that more and more as I worked with the government and intelligence after that, due to that operation and the having survived with only two other team members, we were placed under the control of the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency. And worked for them. I worked for them through 1986. And then after 1986, I went out of payroll of the military into payroll of the United States government under the OSGs, Operational Subgroups, which work for the National Security Group.
And what was your position there, Chip? What was your actual job there?
In the OSGs?
Yeah.
In the OSGs, we have what was called the anti-terrorism group, the terrorist incident working group that was formed in the mid 80s, and they had operational subgroups. The operational subgroups were tasked with overseeing and working toward the national interests of the United States of America, and we were tasked directly under our Security Council, National Security Council. And worked directly for the president under a group called Pegasus Group. We would routinely transport people in and out of countries. We would routinely be charged with intimidating, blackmailing, and sometimes assassinating enemies of the state, those who were considered enemies. Today they call those people terror. They do it under the Anti-Terrorism Act. But even under the Terrorist Incident Working Group, there were national security findings from the Security Council that would allow us to go in and do that. People years ago, when I was in interviews, they said, "Oh, the United States doesn't assassinate people." And now, you know, especially after the war in Iraq, they see that the United States does have their assassination lists. They have the kill lists. We always have had the kill lists, and we had to be very careful in those years to make sure that our backsides were covered. So we required presidents to sign actual orders with a national security finding to cover us. But that's what we did. I was involved.
Chip,
are you able
to take questions from the chat room as well, that we have a live chat room listening in?
I don't mind, no.
Okay. Sorry if I cut across you then. Do you want to finish what you were saying? I apologize.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Oh, well, Jason in the chat room says American military motto is "No one gets left behind," isn't it?
That is the American military motto. But if you're tasked to work for the Central Intelligence Agency, everybody gets left behind if you get caught, and that's who we were working for on that particular mission. We were what's called sheep-dipped out of the United States military and placed into the control of the CIA. The CIA director in the area in that zone was named Bill Colby.
Right, okay. And Salmo Salah in the chat room also, I'm sure that's not his real name, has a question. Did Chip realize at the time he had been set up, or did he not realize this until sometime after? At what point did he realize things were not as they seem?
About the time that... you know, I was a naive 19-year-old kid, just fresh in the Air Force. I was the Air Force. These other guys were CIA, Special Forces, and SEALs, you know. I was a nobody. I was just a communications guy. But I realized that we were really in trouble about the time that Pop, our platoon sergeant, and my way, the captain, jumped out of the truck and shot the guards. I knew we were in trouble then.
Okay, so it basically it unfolded before your eyes.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and they, you could see it in our leader's eyes. You know, they thought something was up. They weren't saying it, but you could get a feel that there was a tenseness there that wasn't normally with them.
But Chip, can I ask you? I mean, this is an incredible betrayal to suddenly, and you're doing your duty, and suddenly you're in an ambush where they're going to take you out. How is it possible to continue working for the same people after you've known that they wanted you dead?
Oh, Molly, they didn't give me that choice. No, I was recovering in a hospital bed. I'd been in a coma for a couple of weeks. I was recovering in a hospital bed in Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. Ambassador Colby came in and debriefed me, and he said, now you have a choice. You can work. The president doesn't trust that you'll keep this quiet, so you're going to fall under the auspices of the CIA. And if you want, you can stay with the Air Force, and we'll control all your missions, or you can come directly to work for us. And I said, oh, hell no, I'm not going to work with you. I've had my experience with you. And so I stayed with the Air Force as a defense intelligence wandering asset. And I was weekly, I was debriefed. They kept good tabs on me.
And as Salma Salah says, I'm sure you felt uncomfortable after this.
that doesn't get close to it, Salam.
Wow. But what put you in a coma, Chip?
When we were ultimately captured, because the aircraft were ordered not to come pick us up from the pickup zone, we were ultimately captured. We'd survived quite some time. Although we would run out of ammo, we would run a little lap, take over an enemy platoon that overran us. Two would stand up to surrender, and the rest of us would recover, take them out, take their weapons and their ammo, and we would continue on. But, you know, we just finally, you know, we were beat, we were tired, and they overcame us. There were just too many of them. And after over a week trying to get across the border to friendly ground, we were captured close to the border. And during our rescue, the Marine Patrol, Marine Recon Patrol, that walked up on the encampment we were being held in, happened to win. And during the course of the firefight, 3 out of 13, out of all of us, only 3 survived. I was shot in the leg in a piece of shrapnel, they believe, hit me in the back of the head and creased my skull and caused some swelling on the brain, and that kept me in the hospital in a coma for a bit. And I ain't been right since, Oli.
And just for clarification, Chip, Colby, he was the director of the CIA at the time, and he actually came to you directly?
No. He was what we today would call the station chief in Southeast Asia for the CIA. He was the man who oversaw the mission. General Haig was assistant to Henry Kissinger in national security. He also oversaw the mission. It was ultimately Haig that ended up getting us out of there.
I just want to mention that Bill Colby is very central in the whole build-up of the Gladio network in Europe. He was stationed at the embassy in Stockholm and other countries as well, being very central in doing this thing.
Yeah, and Sean, at the time, Colby was considered ambassador because we didn't have permission for direct CIA station chiefs in the embassies in those times, so he was considered an assistant ambassador. And it was in the mid-70s that he took over as the director of the CIA.
Okay. So I got my dates wrong a little bit there.
That's okay. Now, this happened in 1971, so this was early.
Right, right.
But he really took you under his wings, didn't he, once you along the way?
He did. And, you know, I admired the man. I know a lot of people don't care for him. But look, he looked out after me. I have no complaints about what he did for me. He taught me how to protect myself for the future. Showed me, made sure I had the best in equipment for collecting my insurance, for doing my work. I was never left without anything I needed. He always saw that I had for my term working for him and under him.
How was he as a person?
He was a good person, you know, just, and his experience, his war stories were great. You know, he worked, he was in World War II as an OSS officer. And, you know, when I would get time to meet with him, we would go out and we'd sit and we'd talk and, he'd tell me, he tried to teach me by explaining some of the ops that he had been on and how he handled those ops. And, he was an out of the box thinker. And that was what was so great about him. And it took me to that same, into that same direction where I started thinking out of the box. And that's how I survived so many years. Had I been a conventional thinker and planner, planning our operations as a, in operational subgroups, we probably never would have survived some of those missions that we went out on. They were pretty crazy.
Mm. Sounds like a wing and a prayer though, Chip. I think you were just very lucky.
Luck has some to do with it.
Okay, well, you do create your own luck, of course.
Yes, you do.
So moving on to being involved with the CIA, I mean, you're a little bit older, maybe a bit wiser, and you also know that you're working for quite a corrupt system.
Well, you know, I was actually working for the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, and under the direction of the CIA until 83, when they placed a lot of us in a place called Fort Campbell, Kentucky, flying helicopters for a group called the 160th Aviation. They had just formed it. If many of you recall, we had a big problem, a debacle in the desert in Iran, where a bunch of our aircraft went in on a hostage rescue mission and they ran into each other. Well, they didn't have a combat controller. I told them that to begin with. But I had finally been able to get out, and in 1978 I left, late 1978, and I was living in Colorado, and I had a nice little deli up there, and I was happy. And one day, a couple of fellows with sunglasses came in, suits and sunglasses, and I thought, "Oh shit!" And they they said, "Mr. Tatum." I said, "Yep." They said, "Uncle Sam wants you again, son." I said, "Well, you know, I have my family here. I'm retired. I'm not really." He said, "Oh no, here's your problem. You see, you're in the reserves still. You've just been activated." So they reactivated me. They sent me to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, not in the Air Force, in the Army. And the Army, those guys are crazy. They get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and run and exercise and all that stuff. I mean, that was nuts. But they made us, they sent us to, the new groups that they brought in. They made us warrant officers, sent us to a place called Fort Rucker, Alabama. They had, in these groups now, they had not one pilot. They had all special ops personnel that they brought in. And they were forming this new group, and from Fort Rucker, we were sent to Fort Campbell. Fort Campbell, we were given taskings to fly Chinooks, to fly Blackhawks, to fly Little Birds, and I took the Little Birds. And we were taught mostly night vision techniques. Almost everything we did was under goggles, under night vision. And then we were taught to taught taskings on how to attack and avoid different kinds of radar. Having been an air traffic controller, I understood the radar side very well, and I was very adept at getting under radar and sneaking up on our targets. And everyone wondered, "How do you do that? How do you do that?" I said, "I don't know how I do it. I just, you know, I understand the radar systems, and it's just not difficult for me to do." And folks, the 160th, if you'll recall recently, a raid going into Pakistan where a helicopter crashed, and it was kind of a weird-looking helicopter. That was the 160th. That was the group that I was with for years and years.
So, Ollie, have you got any another direction you want us to go in, or should we continue?
No, I was just this was the unit you were in when the attack on Granada was done, wasn't it?
We were, and the only thing we had going for us on the Grenada attack was the the element of surprise. Look, the Cubans were on the ground in Granada. They had what was on the airport where we were tasked, the little birds were tasked to go into, was a thing called a ZSU-23-4. And a ZSU-23-4 is a Russian radar-guided Russian anti-aircraft weapon that can fire. I think that our CO told us it's like 3,000 rounds a minute or something like that, an anti-aircraft fire. That's a lot of lead coming at you. And it's radar controlled. It stays under manual control. They can run it manually or radar. And they always had it off at night. So our element of surprise, we were sitting offshore in ships getting ready to come in at O-Dark 30 in the morning under the element of surprise. And I think the president came on national radio or television. It's not having been here in the States when he did that. We were out on the ships. I believe it was 3 in the morning he announced the raid, and we were to fly in off the top of the waves right into the airport and take out the Cuban contingency, military contingency that was there. And but some senator decided that was unethical. And so although we had asked Cuba several times and warned Cuba to get their people off of the island and quit building their new military base there at the airport, they ignored it. And they finally said, if you don't do it, we're going to have to take action. And they still ignored it. Well, this senator decided to tell him, well, the forces are on their way. Hmm. And with that, we lost the element of surprise. They turned on the radar. They turned the gun toward us, and it took us 2 days and several less lives and aircraft to take that out. As a matter of fact, it was a picture of me in a Kentucky newspaper standing next to my little bird, my OH-6. It didn't wake no more. It had too many holes in it. It was half in and half out of the water, and I was standing next to it looking at it when the photographer came past.
Good photo opportunity there, Chip.
Yeah.
Jillian,
you know, I didn't even realize that it was there, except when I went back and a bunch of friends up at the officers' club, because no one knew we left. We were a very secret group back on the back side of the base, and no one could come in or out of the compound that we flew in and out of and worked out of. And they said, hey, Tatum, where you been? I said, oh, just, you know, little TDY over in a recruiting command thing, went to Union City to the Banana Festival or something like that, I told them. They said, yeah, and they threw the paper in front of me, and who's that? Showing me on the beach in Grenada.
Your doppelganger, of course, you told them.
Right. And, you know, the guy who oversaw missions for the 160th, they fell under the guidance of the National Reconnaissance Office. His name was Oliver North, and he'd been there several times. To Fort Campbell briefings and bringing in brass and showing them what we were building there. And he was very proud of the unit,
I'm sure. And he certainly became very infamous or famous a few years later. Jillian in the chat room is saying, is there a way to detect people looking at you with night vision goggles? Interesting question, but I thought I'd throw it at you.
Not unless you have some too.
There you go, Jillian. You need to have them as well. There you go.
Actually, yeah. You know, there are systems. I think I'm thinking Amsterdam has an electronics company that will detect the emissions from the night vision goggles, so you can see a little glow around them if you have this other special goggle. But it's special equipment. There's no way with the naked eye or the naked person to do it. No.
Okay. Robin there says, wave a bright torch about to see if any fall out of the trees.
Right. Well, you know, and one thing that if you have a bright light or bright lights, it shuts down the goggles. So it'll momentarily shut them down.
Okay.
So
yeah. Gives an opportunity. Have that torch ready.
That's right.
So well, a man called North, he became very, very important in your life from 83 and onwards, yeah?
Yes, he did, 83 all the way to the end, and into today. Yeah. Hate the
he's
guy.
Still around?
Yeah, he's still alive. He's, I think he's a contributor, works with Fox News Network.
You're
Rupert
kidding.
Murdoch's group.
All the truth comes out via that network.
Yeah, right.
I think we're going to have to work towards being the next mainstream media, you know, Chip, because there's absolutely no way you're going to get this type of information out onto the mainstream.
No. I had even part of my training from Colby was collecting documents, making recordings, making audio and video recordings, and some of those documents I collected while I was flying missions in Honduras during what was ended up being called the Iran-Contra scandal for North. We were flying in and out of different areas of Honduras, flying into the Contra camps that he built, and flying equipment in, personnel equipment in, and flying other things out. And so a lot of those things were coolers, and those coolers were the huge white coolers, had to be like 110 quart coolers, and they'd have over 100 kilos of cocaine in them each time we flew them out. When I confronted North about it, when I called the Washington switch and confronted him, and even when he came out, I said, "What the hell's going on with this, Colonel?" He said, "Well, it's nothing more than it's all going as to the international courts to prosecute the Sandinistas of Nicaragua. They're the ones making it." I said, "What do you mean they're the ones making it? I go into these camps. I see the vats. I see what we're doing in there. Why are we doing this?" He said, "You just don't worry about it. It's not your job. You're not in that pay grade." All right, sir.
So they were just saying it was evidence being used in courts when in fact you were guilty, I suppose, without knowledge, with nescience, of drug trafficking on behalf of the military into the states and other countries.
It ended up I was probably one of the best drug pilots in the world without knowing it and without getting paid for it, Sean. Yeah. That's the bad part. I mean, but we met with guys like Barry Seal. He would come in and out of San Lorenzo on one coast of Honduras to pick up these coolers. Other coolers we would ship out of La Mesa and airports to C-130s, Panamanian and U.S. C-130s heading toward Panama. Now, Barry would always go north, and the others would always go south into Panama, drop them off, and then from there, Noriega would oversee the shipment into the U.S. Or to other parts of the world. I'm not sure. Who knows where it went from there? I just know it left and what it left in. And what I did is, every time we fly in the military, we have to file a flight plan with the air base. We were at Pomerola Air Base, which is the Air Force Academy for the Honduran government, for the Honduran Air Force Base. And we filed these flight plans, and I would write on the flight plans who we flew, and on the back of them I'd make notes. And years later, I had those tucked away in the mid-80s, and years later I went back and collected them. And I published all those flight plans, got them certified by the Honduran government, and published them in a thing called the Tatum Chronicles. We gave that to the government. We gave it to the Department of Justice. They just said, "Yeah, okay, all right, And nothing ever happened.
Incredible.
We even went to the Integrity Department of the Department of Justice and talked to them about it, and they said, "Yeah, okay, all right." And this wasn't only me. I mean, I had co-pilot, medics, and everything on board the aircraft with me. It was a group of us. Didn't care for what we were doing, but no.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It is what it is.
It is incredible.
What they say.
Yeah, and not only were you not being paid for it, i.e. the drug running, the American public were paying for it. Basically, to
their taxes. Yeah, a lot of drugs came here. You know, there's a new movie out. It's called... Don't murder the messenger, or murder the messenger, or something about the Gary Webb story. It's a national movie now. It's out in all the cinemas, and it's about Iran-Contra and how he uncovered a conspiracy to ship what he called crack cocaine into the United States. But you know, he got that wrong, and I have to tell you, we weren't shipping crack cocaine. We were shipping cocaine, and we didn't care what they made it into once it got to the United States.
Right. It's incredible. So did you stop doing those flights when you found out the coolers were full of cocaine, or did you have more flights to do and therefore you had to continue?
You don't just say you just continue doing what you do and get out of there as quick as you can. Get back to the military base, get back out of that environment. You just keep working.
That's incredible.
You know, the only thing you can do is go to your, you're in the military. The only thing you can do is go to your superiors and tell them. I had no superior there. I was it. So I had North to report to.
Chip, can I ask you the whole purpose with the Contras Army? What was that?
You know, Ole, they said it was for because there was threat of a communist regime coming into Central America, and it was too close to our borders for communist regimes. But in the 70s, we started putting satellites up, and we put satellites all over the place, the 70s and 80s, and we had a central telemetry point that those were supposed to report to. Those satellites were supposed to report to a place in the Caribbean called Swan Island, and we built a large facility out on Swan Island to receive all the military satellite data and then transfer it back to the U.S. to our National Reconnaissance Office. But we missed. And there was a little place in Honduras called Carrot Top, a little radar station that they could collect all that data at. And Russia found out about it. Cuba found out about it. They all found out about it, and so they decided they were going to try to take over Honduras and be able to control that data coming off of our military satellites. I feel that that's probably what a lot of it was about. And then the opportunity came up for the cocaine, and the powers that be jumped on that very quickly.
There are also some theories about that they wanted a genocide of the people in these countries to avoid immigration into the States. I have no idea if there's any truth to that.
You know, I can't go there, Ole, because I have no idea. I know this. I know with this current Ebola outbreak, if it ever did get to Central America, they would never be able to control the people coming into the United States if the epidemic hits Central or South America. They'd zoom for the United States because the healthcare down there is, you know, a lot worse than up here.
Mm. And do you guys, both of you, wouldn't mind asking you both, do you think this Ebola crisis, you know, along with Spanish flu, bird flu, and whatever else they want to panic people with, do you think it's real? Man-made or what?
I think it's real and accelerated by man on purpose.
Okay. Ollie?
I believe it's totally created in laboratories and that there's a lot of scaremongering going on, but that the threat is there, you know, so that if they want to release it, they can really accomplish incredible damage. But at this point, I think a lot of scaremongering. And if you see the thing here in Spain, and so once again, so badly done, it's just ridiculous, the whole thing with this... with this woman being brought in here with a military plane, the pilots didn't even have masks or anything on, and the way they carried it out on a two-man stretcher instead. I mean, you would never do that with a somebody where in such a serious state and where the risk of this Ebola getting out there, you would be at least four. Also, the people that are supposed to be medical people, they stand and salute the ambulance. I mean, it's so obvious that these are military people, including a military plane. And inside this whole thing incubates, there's no one really there. You can just see a lot of... I think that part of it, just a big false flag or psyop.
Yeah, and also, I mean, there's two ways, maybe, well, there's 100 infinite ways of looking at it, but we're getting reports now, whether they're true reports or not, we do not know until we do our research a bit more, that the vaccines themselves being used are making people ill and sick and spreading the Ebola more than it itself.
No, but this is the whole
point. Sean, I wrote about this back in April, and the United Nations, it all started... synchronistically, when the United Nations was in Africa, mm-hmm. doing vaccines, and all of a sudden this show started showing up and started spreading. Look, if they want to stop the spread to the United States, you shut the international airports in Africa, and no one can fly to the United States if they're infected. That's as easy as it is. And if you're in a bio, any military person, any well-trained nurse knows that if you're in a biohazard, a high biohazard environment, you cover completely. And they don't.
Yeah,
so absolutely. What's up with that? There's a lot of inconsistency.